From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. On this International Women's Day, President Biden is marking the occasion as only a president can, with more executive orders. His signature will set up a new White House Council on Gender Policy and roll back a controversial Trump administration rule that protected students accused of sexual assault. We're joined now by NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe. And Aisha, why don't we start with this order on sexual violence in schools? What do we need to know?
So this order basically directs the Department of Education to look at or and to conduct a review of all of its policies and regulations to make sure that an educational environment is free from discrimination on the basis of sex, and also free from discrimination in the form of sexual harassment, including sexual violence, and discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. So basically, it's a review to make sure that all of its policies are aligned with this order.
And as I understand it, it goes back to the former education secretary, Betsy DeVos. She and the Trump administration believed that people who were accused of sexual violence deserve more rights in an academic setting. And Democrats, of course, opposed that from the beginning. Does this order just revert the legal standard back to what it was during the Obama administration?
So this executive order clearly seems aimed at undoing that policy from the Trump administration. But what it basically does is it directs Education Secretary Miguel Cardona to suspend or revise any agency actions that are at odds with the new order from the White House. So it basically puts it in the Education Secretary's court for him to look at the policies and to decide what to do. But it seems clearly aimed at eventually getting rid of that order from the Trump administration.
Okay, more to come on that issue, I'm sure. Now, another Biden order is establishing a White House Gender Policy Council. What will that do exactly?
So this council will focus on ensuring equity for women and girls, and particularly women and girls of color. This is a revamped version of former President Obama's White House Council on Women and Girls. The name was changed to reflect that all genders can face discrimination, but it's basically a way of looking at equity when it comes to women.
Well, President Biden, on another issue, is trying to expand voting rights. He issued this executive order yesterday. He's responding to efforts by Republicans in state capitals around the country who are trying to make it harder to vote. Here's the president.
Every eligible voter should be able to vote and have that vote counted. If you have the best ideas, you have nothing to hide. Let the people vote.
President Biden also urged the Senate to take up voting rights measures that were passed by the House Democrats. But Aisha, without Congress here, how much can an executive order on voting rights really accomplish?
It certainly can't go as far as some activists want it to go, and it cannot do what the law or what some Democrats are trying to do in passing legislation. But this order directs federal agencies to develop a strategic plan for promoting voter registration and participation. So it's directing agencies to try to get more people registered to vote. It also is looking at trying to expand access to voting for active duty members of the military, as well as eligible federally incarcerated people. So it's trying to get more people registered to vote. But as far as dealing with some of the obstacles that people face to voting, that is something that will likely have to come through legislation.
Right. And just briefly, what do these orders say about how the president is trying to get his agenda through that divided Congress?
Well, it seems like what the president is trying to do is do what he can through executive order, and also but try to force Congress to move. And even if that means moving not on necessarily a bipartisan level, what they argue is they're pushing policies that have bipartisan support from the public, even if Republicans in Congress aren't voting for these policies.
NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's go to Kenya now, where East Africa's richest nation has begun vaccinating people after receiving just over 1 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine through the global vaccine COVAX program. Nearly 110,000 people have tested positive for COVID-19, and close to 2,000 people have died there. The priority is now to vaccinate frontline health workers, immigration and security officials, those over 50 and older, and individuals with pre-existing health conditions. And for the latest, let's bring in Ishmael Inashe, a journalist based in Nairobi. He joins us on Skype. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
As I mentioned, more than 100,000 people have tested positive. Nearly 2,000 have died from this virus there. Can you put those numbers into context? What regions of the country are most impacted?
I think the first thing to say is that COVID-19 pandemic has really shown up the limits and issues that the Kenyan healthcare system has. And the Kenyan healthcare landscape is largely made up of a mixture of private, public, and faith-based system. And also, on top of that, they're just not testing nearly enough. So it's really difficult to know how many people have tested positive for COVID-19, and indeed how many people have died. In terms of where the location of these infections are taking place is largely within the urban areas initially. So Nairobi, where we are, is about a city of 4 million people. Mombasa and the coastal areas on the Indian Ocean. But also, actually, it's increasingly moved into the rural areas. And 70% of Kenya's 52 million population live in rural areas. Hmm.
52 million people, most live in rural areas. You laid out that patchwork of the healthcare system. I mean, this is probably why, in large part, we're seeing this huge task to inoculate healthcare workers. We're reading that hundreds of healthcare workers have tested positive for COVID-19. Back in December, doctors employed in Kenya's public hospitals went on strike, which ended days later. But what more can you tell us about what's happening in those healthcare centers? I mean, it sounds pretty dire.
The situation has been really terrible. As you mentioned, healthcare workers have gone on strike a number of times last year, most recently from before Christmas, and the strike was suspended only 2 weeks ago, but there was a strike in August, and as the pandemic began, various issues they were highlighting in terms of taking this strike action. One of them is the lack of protective gears. Also, a lot of them complained about the fact that their salaries were delayed. This issue has been a real problem, not just for Kenya, but across African countries, because their healthcare systems are largely weak. And unfortunately, this pandemic has meant that they haven't had the resources and the capacity to be able to really deal with it effectively. And Kenya is this region, East Africa's biggest economy, and they probably have a better healthcare system than most in the regions. And still, they have had some pretty difficult issues in terms of treating people who've got COVID and in terms of protecting healthcare workers and giving them equipment they need to do their jobs.
I want to ask you more about the impact on the economy. The country's health minister, Mutahi Kagwe, stressed last week how the introduction of vaccines is in no way signifying the war on COVID is over. Let's listen.
What we have received here is the equivalent, metaphorically speaking, to acquisition of machine guns, bazookas, and tanks to fight this war against COVID-19.
And Kagwe was speaking at the airport as those vaccines were being received. I mean, as you mentioned, Kenya is an important economic driver. It's a tourism hotspot. It accounts for a significant portion of the nation's economy. How badly has the tourism industry been impacted by all of this?
I think the tourism industry, which, by the way, is one of the main ways in which Kenya gets dollars, has been deeply impacted by the global COVID-19 pandemic and because of these global measures that countries which send tourists to Kenya, such as the United States and the UK and countries in Europe, have taken these measures which have made their citizens unable to travel. The issue here is that, you know, tourism is such a disproportionate part of the economy because of the dollars it brings into the economy. You know, it employs literally hundreds of thousands of people and they've been out of work. And another issue on top of all of this is that unlike a country, say, in the United States or in the UK, where the governments have taken measures to support their citizens and businesses, there just hasn't been the same you know, capacity here. And Kenya is certainly, in terms of the region, one of the countries that has probably done more than others, but still, it's been really impacted quite badly.
Ishmael, it sounds like everything really rests on this vaccine.
It does. And I think I have to just remind you, Kenya has received only 1 million doses of the Oxford AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine. And this is 1 million. And Kenya has an estimated population of 52 million people. So it's a full year since the pandemic began. And I think, unfortunately, the picture looks somewhat grim for African countries and poorer nations. They're probably unlikely to vaccinate their populations for many years to come.
That's journalist Ishmael Anache. He is in Nairobi talking with us about vaccination efforts in Kenya. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
On June 28, 2018, in an event that is all too familiar in America today, a gunman shot and killed five employees of the Capital Gazette newspaper in Annapolis, Maryland. NPR's Chris Benderev spent 2 years getting to know survivors of the shooting, and he tells their stories in a new podcast from NPR's Embedded team. In the first of 4 episodes, we hear about the shooting and meet one of the survivors, Celine Sanfelice. A warning here, this story contains vivid descriptions of violence.
Here's what happened. Around 2:30 in the afternoon, a man with a shotgun fired into and exploded a huge glass door at the entrance of the Capital Gazette newsroom. And then he stepped inside. The gunman made his way through the reception area and down the main hallway that ran through the middle of the office, shooting over and over. As the gunman moved towards the back of the newsroom, Celine, as she told CNN later, made a decision.
I said, I'm getting out of here, and I grabbed my purse and I went to the back door, which I was only a couple steps away from. It was locked. And I said, it's locked.
The back door, which was the only other way out of the office, wouldn't open because the gunman had barricaded it. So Celine hid under a desk.
After surviving the shooting, Capital Gazette journalists went right back to work, publishing a paper the very next day. But the trauma stayed with them. Today, we're going to hear an excerpt from the Embedded podcast focusing on Celine Sanfelice's return to work. Here's Chris Benderev again.
The boss at the Capital Gazette is Rick Hutzel, who kind of looks like one of those khakis-wearing newspaper editors in the movie Spotlight. And one of the first things I learned about Rick is that he loves talking about Maryland history. Like, sometimes, out of nowhere, he'll say stuff like...
So the Federalist Papers, those were not printed in the Maryland Gazette, but there were local people having the same debate. It's fascinating, and it was a weekly paper.
What Rick does not love talking about is himself. I'm not comfortable being the story, he'd say. And in the months right after the shooting, he was also not comfortable letting in outside journalists, including me, to the new office that his team was working from. First, he told me there were issues of security. They'd been advised to keep the address of their new location secret. And secondly, the office that they'd been temporarily working out of, which someone had loaned them, it was really small. It was the space normally meant for 5 college journalism students, but now it had to fit 15 reporters. Everyone was elbow to elbow. Rick technically had a corner office, but he couldn't even fully stretch his legs in it.
It's a little tiny office, and my feet are too big for it.
More than that, though, Rick said that his employees still needed privacy in this tiny newsroom, where people sometimes would still just break down. He was working on finding them a bigger, more permanent newsroom. And in the meantime, Rick did agree to let me talk to some of his staff outside of the new location. Do you remember what it was like to walk in?
Yeah, I remember, like, meeting Lon and being like, this is the security guard who's going to be here with you. And I was like, okay, we have a security guard. That makes me feel better. This guy's massive, and I think he has a gun. So I was like, all right, that seems safe.
That's Celine again. She told me that even with the armed guard, she found it really hard to feel safe enough, though. She did this thing that a lot of the other people who'd been in the room for the shooting did. She made sure to pick a desk where she could have her back up against a wall with a clear view of the front door.
Because when people would come in, it would make this noise, and you didn't know who was coming in. And then if somebody didn't have the code, there was like a doorbell, and that was like so scary. So I was like, I just want to see who's coming in the room.
She says that even normal sounds, like that doorbell, would send her into a panic.
Your first thought is like, he's back, or somebody's come to get me.
So those first couple weeks, Celine couldn't actually do much work. But about a month after the shooting, she did go out on a story. Celine did an article where she checked in with people who'd survived a big tornado 1 year earlier. But she says, even though she was there to talk about their tragedy, they'd often end up talking about hers.
People would tell you about where they were when they heard that the shooting was happening. I was in Walmart. I was camping. And then you get on with your job and your story.
Celine knows they didn't mean to, but these people's stories would often end up making her relive the shooting too, which was upsetting. Every stage of putting together a newspaper story was different now for Celine. Like, after she finally wrote up a draft of her tornado story, it was time for an edit. But that was another reminder of the shooting, because her editor used to be Rob Hyacin. She'd loved Rob. Everybody loved Rob. Because he wasn't just a good editor. He was a teacher, someone who taught reporters how to fit more humanity into their writing. But Rob wasn't here anymore. Celine had a new editor, a nice guy, who'd come to Annapolis to help fill in during the summer.
And I remember I had my first meeting with him. It was really great. It was awesome. But it felt so bad to get that from somebody that wasn't Rob. And then I just went out in the hallway and cried. It was just that feeling of like, I'm never going to get that from Rob again. He's never going to edit any more of my stories. And I'm going to have to find a way to be a good writer without him. And I don't know how to do that.
Celine did get used to churning out more stories, especially when she took over the entertainment section of the paper. But that meant filling big shoes, because entertainment used to be Wendy Winter's job before she was killed in the shooting. And Wendy had been prolific. She did write-ups for what seemed like every concert and play and restaurant and charity fundraiser in the Annapolis area. Plus, she did weekly profiles that readers loved, like Home of the Week. She regularly put in 60 to 80-hour work weeks. Wendy actually pre-wrote so many stories that her byline kept appearing in the paper for weeks after the shooting. And at first, Celine had been game to pick up Wendy's beat. But by early December, she was struggling to publish even half the number of stories that Wendy had. And lately, people in Annapolis have been asking if she, as Wendy's replacement, would be covering their holiday event this year. You know, like Wendy always did. Oh, they'd add, and why hasn't there been a Home of the Week every week anymore? One day, after work, Celine recorded a voice memo for me about all this. And in it, it was like she was longing for the days when people had brought up the shooting too much.
People don't even say sorry. Like, people have stopped saying, like, hey, I'm sorry. Wendy used to do this, but who will do it? Now it's just, Wendy used to do it, who's gonna do it? And it just feels like everyone else is back to normal. It feels like a lot of people have forgotten what that day was like. I guess my point is that I'm still really sad. And all I just really want is for Rob to read my stories again. It was just so much easier. We had such a big space. And now we're all crammed up in this little space and everything is so loud.
You know which one's yours?
I think, yeah, am I this one? Or I think Chase is the end and I'm the second to the end? Yeah.
In June 2019, almost a year after the shooting, the Capital Gazette finally moved out of that tiny, temporary newsroom and into their own much bigger office, which had a steel security door and 2 inches of Kevlar lining the inside of the walls. On the first day, Celine started by setting up her new desk right next to Danielle's.
Okay, first things first, how do I make it stand?
You just press the up button. Yeah.
Oh,
it's pretty good.
I'm not even this tall.
A couple hours later, I was interviewing Celine in one of the large new conference rooms.
Pictures, and then there was like a camera with a big light.
And suddenly,
Yeah.
Well, but yesterday...
This loud, shrill fire alarm went off. Celine jolted upright. She inhaled sharply. And then...
It's okay. There's just wiring stuff going on.
She calmly said that it must be wiring stuff, because it was a brand new building. And she was right. It was a false alarm. Celine had spent the past year in therapy. She told me that she learned ways to breathe deeply or tap her knees in an alternating pattern to calm herself when she got startled. Basically, ways to remind her body, you're not in a shooting again. It wasn't like everything was fixed. Some noises still sent her into a panic. But mostly...
It feels like I'm a normal person, which is awesome. There's only like, you know, when these little moments happen that it kind of reminds me that I am not. But I'm okay with that.
Work was improving too for Celine. She'd recently reported a big, ambitious story. It'd been hard to find sources willing to talk to her. People weren't responding to her emails and Facebook requests. And then she remembered a piece of advice from her former editor, Rob. Sometimes you have to be willing to leave the office.
And it was funny because Rob had sent me on a couple of door-knocking assignments that he knew I didn't want to go on. And I was like, this isn't how you get things anymore.
But this time, Rob was right.
And... somehow it happened that through door knocking, I had the most success.
When the story finally went to print, people around town told her how good it was and that she should feel proud and happy about the work that she'd done. And for the first time in a while, Celine did.
NPR's Chris Benderev talking with Celine Sanfelice of the Capital Gazette newspaper. The story comes from NPR's Embedded podcast, and you can hear the rest of the series at npr.org/embedded. Or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Consider This podcast, we help you make sense of one big story in the news every day, like how to combat disinformation and conspiracy theories, which pose a real threat to democracy, and what life looks like after you're vaccinated, the next phase of do's and don'ts. All that in 15 minutes every weekday. Listen now to Consider This from NPR.
People who are fully vaccinated against COVID-19 or soon will be should listen up. The CDC has released highly anticipated guidelines for Americans who are 2 weeks past their second dose of the Moderna or Pfizer vaccines. And the headline is that those people can now safely visit with other fully vaccinated people without wearing masks. Let's bring in NPR Science Desk correspondent Allison Aubrey. Hi, Allison.
Hey, good to be here.
Good to have you. And this is news that millions of people have been waiting for because they want to know, does this mean that grandma and grandpa can safely come over and visit the kids if they've gotten those shots? What's the CDC saying?
Yeah, well, if grandma and grandpa are local to where the grandkids are, there's a green light here. I mean, basically the agency is saying fully vaccinated people can gather indoors with other fully vaccinated people without wearing masks or social distancing. They can also gather unmasked with people from another household who are at low risk of serious illness and are not vaccinated. So those would be the grandchildren. But the agency says vaccinated people should continue to mask when they're in public, avoid crowds, and take other precautions when they're with unvaccinated people who might be at high risk of serious illness from COVID-19.
I mentioned Pfizer and Moderna. I also want to say that this will apply to people once they are 2 weeks past the single dose of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. What does all this say about how scientists are feeling about whether or not fully vaccinated people are spreading the virus? Anything else there?
So Yeah, well, I mean, basically, CDC officials are saying that there is accumulating evidence that people who are fully vaccinated are, you know, much less likely to become infected, and are the word they're using are potentially less likely to spread the virus to others. You know, as the data comes in from Israel and other places, in Israel where more than half the population has received a vaccine shot, the risk of this seems to be quite low, but there's still some question about this. It's not completely nailed down. So as the science evolves, there will be likely more updated guidance soon.
You've hinted at a few of the caveats here. This doesn't mean that vaccinated people can just go around everywhere they want to unprotected, right?
That's right. I mean, the vast majority of the population is not vaccinated yet, so lots of people are still vulnerable to the virus. And there's a lot of recent data to show that, you know, places like gyms and restaurants are places where the risk of spread can be higher. You know, at restaurants, think about it, people are unmasked as they eat. In gyms, when people work out, they're breathing heavier, forcing those respiratory particles out further. And if they happen to be infected and asymptomatic, the risk of transmission would be higher. That's why the protections are still in place.
Yeah, and yet it is a sign of hope, isn't it? I mean, I just go back to that example from the beginning, grandma and grandpa, family. People are longing for their families to be back together.
Absolutely. This is like it's getting close, we all are. I know, right? I am. That's right.
What does that say about where we are in this fight against the virus?
You know, I think where we are at this moment is that, look, there are still about 60,000 cases a day. The virus is still circulating. We still have a lot of deaths daily. And so this guidance is a reflection that we've made progress, that vaccination helps a whole lot. But the pandemic isn't over, and lots more people need to be vaccinated.
All right. NPR Science Desk correspondent Allison Aubrey, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Schools are looking for ways to catch up students who've fallen behind in the pandemic. And one option is, cover your ears, kids, summer school. Federal money for summer school is included in the new COVID-19 relief bill. And our next guest says her schools will need it because the district is expanding summer classes this year. Maria Vasquez is the deputy superintendent for Orange County Public Schools, serving the area around Orlando, Florida. Maria, welcome.
Hello.
And what did you see with your students that made you think that expanding summer school was the right move?
We have been monitoring our students' progress and have noted that there has been significant learning loss, more significantly so in those students who are learning from home. We knew we needed to expand learning opportunities, hence our decision to expand our current summer school that would normally run through the just in the month of June to the months of June and July.
Okay. And some context here is that your school system has a hybrid model where you've got some kids who are doing in-person learning, and you also have some families that are doing remote learning. Now, when you say learning loss, what does that mean? How would you quantify that?
Our students have been learning from home since March of last year, and we give periodic benchmark assessments, and our most recent data was in January, and while our students made progress from the beginning of the school year, when we look at that same moment in time last year, there are regressions across the board.
And you're talking reading, writing, math, science, that sort of thing.
Correct. We will focus at the elementary level during the summer on the English language arts, which includes reading and writing, as well as mathematics. At the secondary level, we will be expanding it to more courses, including social studies and science.
Now, for those kids who are falling behind, will this be mandatory?
It is not mandatory. We are very hopeful that our summer school will be enticing to those families that have students learning from home because it will be a smaller number of children attending. We currently have about 60% of our students attending face-to-face instruction 5 days a week. in the summer, that will be significantly fewer number of students. We will continue to have all of the safety protocols in place, including mandatory wearing of masks. Many of the families who have chosen to keep their children at home and learn from home are doing so because there is a fear of having them bring the virus to the home and thus impacting family members who may have health conditions. So we really believe that all of those factors are going to encourage our families to send their children to face-to-face summer school.
Now, I imagine teachers who've been working this year are absolutely and totally exhausted and won't just want a break come summer, but are actually going to need one. So how are you going to address that issue so that your teachers don't burn out?
Absolutely. And I've got to tell you that our teachers have done an incredible job this year supporting our children. So what we are looking to offer for this summer is they can choose to work the month of June and have the month of July off. They can team teach. One might want to teach every other week. So,
but they will be required to work that summer school?
No, it's optional.
I see. Well, and it's not just the teachers, is it? It's the families. For those who can afford it, summer vacation is, you know, often a time for camps or vacations. Are you hearing from parents who are concerned that it's their kids that also need a break after a tough year?
We have heard from some families, but the vast majority of the families who are learning from home see not only the academic loss, but the social emotional impact learning from home and not having those interactions have had on their children. So many of them are very thankful that their children are going to have the opportunity to be able to recoup some of that lost learning.
Summer school, as I'm sure you can appreciate, is just one tool that you have to fight against the learning loss that your kids have experienced this year. But, you know, we're also seeing across the country that thousands of kids just stopped going to school during this pandemic. How long lasting do you think the burden of this past year will be on your schools and your teachers and these kids and families?
Well, I've read where it may take up to 3 years for some of our children to regain some of the loss that they have experienced. I do think that we are also going to have to deal with the emotional toll the pandemic has had on our children, especially those that have been at home. That's why my team is currently mapping out what extended learning opportunities we will be able to provide and what supports we're going to be providing to them to help address the social impact the pandemic has had. So we're at a point where we're not going to go back to schools before the pandemic. While COVID-19 has wreaked havoc on all of our lives, it's also provided us the opportunity to rethink what school looks like, to rethink time, resources, and space so that we can build a better educational system for our children so that all children are learning at high levels.
Maria Vasquez, Deputy Superintendent for Orange County Public Schools in Orlando, Florida. Maria, thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
We're approaching the one-year anniversary of when many states went into lockdown to battle the coronavirus, and some NPR member stations are following up with people they spoke to earlier in this pandemic. Colorado Public Radio's Claire Cleveland profiled people experiencing lasting symptoms from the virus, and she got back in touch with one of these long haulers to see how he's doing 1 year on.
Ty Godwin has had shortness of breath, occasional fever, malaise, and restless legs at night for an entire year. Last January, he traveled internationally for work. When he got home, he had mild symptoms of COVID-19, but there were no tests available. When I first spoke to Godwin, he was on day 93 of having a fever. He was struggling to breathe, to keep up with his job, and to figure out what was wrong.
I was a marathon runner and a triathlete before this. I'm out of breath right now, but I can't exercise. I've had nights where I wake up out of breath.
Ty Godwin is an example of the 1 in 3 people who will experience COVID-19 symptoms for longer than 2 weeks, and one of a growing number of people who experience symptoms for many weeks or even months. There's still no formal diagnosis for what's now called long COVID, nor is there a treatment. But there are clinics that have popped up across the country dedicated to COVID-19 recovery. Godwin goes to one at National Jewish Health in Denver. While the health impacts have challenged Godwin, he says there's a layer of depression that has set in on top of it all. He's not alone in struggling with his mental health.
I cry way more than I should at my age because the emotions hit you. Am I going to be around for life events? I have a lot more thoughts about my mortality, and depression is real.
In a survey study done by UC Health Memorial Hospital in Colorado Springs, long COVID patients reported distress, anxiety, depression, and a lot of fear. Dr. Robert Lamb led the study.
1 in 5 patients that are infected with COVID-19 end up having a mental health diagnosis within the next 3 months of their recovery. So that, I think, is particularly disturbing.
In the coming years, much of the conversation around COVID-19 will be about recovery. But for long haulers like Godwin, he's focusing on getting better.
I'm a marathon runner and I'm mile 20 and I've got 6 miles to go.
Today, Godwin's on medical leave from work and will travel to the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota on March 11th in hopes of finding more answers about why he can't shake the virus. For Here and Now, I'm Claire Cleveland.
David Duchovny is best known for his role in the long-running TV series The X-Files. He played FBI agent Fox Mulder, believer in alien abduction, who investigates paranormal cases with his skeptical partner, Dana Scully, played by Gillian Anderson.
Mulder, it's the same story I've heard since I was a kid. It's a folk tale, a myth.
I heard the same story when I was a kid, too. Funny thing is, I believed it.
But David Duchovny also has a master's in English literature. And in the last few years, he's turned his talents to writing novels. The most recent one, Truly Like Lightning, came out last month. Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa interviewed David Duchovny about his book for a virtual event held by the Massachusetts-based Brookline Booksmith. And she brings us this story.
A Zoom crowd eagerly awaited David Duchovny. In her introduction, Brianna Tribuna spoke for many of the fans.
David Duchovny has been a constant in my life since The X-Files first aired, and I was just a weird little kid obsessed with Bigfoot, werewolves, and aliens.
I also had The X-Files on the brain, along with Duchovny's academic past.
When I started this book, I did something that I don't usually do, which is I immediately leapt to the acknowledgments because I was like, where did this come from? There are two things that sort of leapt out at me. One is that it was partly the writings of a professor that you had when you were at graduate school at Yale, Harold Bloom. And then the other connection was The X-Files and an episode you wrote for The X-Files. Yeah. So could you talk about that?
Sure. In 2000, you know, I was able to like write and direct basically 1 X-File a year after the 6th year. So I had this idea that was kind of inspired by the case of a guy named Mark Hoffman. He was a forger of Joseph Smith, basically.
Yes, that Joseph Smith, founder of the Mormon Church, now known as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
And the thing about Mark Hoffman is when he was writing in the hand of Joseph Smith, he said they weren't forgeries because he was channeling Joseph Smith. And so that's what I kind of used. You know, it intrigued me as an actor because we talk about becoming a character.
In Duchovny's X-Files episode, an old hippie named Micah Hoffman, played by Paul Lieber, forges ancient texts about Jesus Christ to fool a Catholic cardinal. But then Micah has a conversion.
One day I was not just impersonating Jesus Christ. I had become him. That's why I blew up the crypt. The forgeries were blasphemous and needed to be destroyed.
Fast forward about 2 decades. Duchovny is working on Truly Like Lightning, which centers around Bronson Powers, a former Hollywood stuntman who is disillusioned by the business and finds solace in religion.
There was something about the Mormon sense of we are not belated, we are now, and now is when miracles are happening, that struck me as if you had somebody like Bronson who feels it's hard for him to have an authentic life. He would glom onto this religion. So that's how it started.
Like the text in the X-Files episode, Bronson's brand of Mormonism is something he made up. And yes, it involves polygamy. Bronson and his two wives live on an isolated settlement near California's Joshua Tree National Park. They homeschool their 10 children and raise them free from technology and what they view as the evils of society. But then a real estate developer, who covets Bronson's land, bets him that his children would benefit by attending public school. Despite his misgivings, Bronson agrees to enroll three of his kids and let them live in a city along with one of the mothers.
We're going to take these kids who have never seen another human being, and we're going to give them cell phones, and we're going to give them pizza, and we're going to give them Michael Jackson, and we're going to give them all the things. What happens when you take a 19th century person and put them in the 21st century?
What follows will cause Patriarch Bronson to question the faith that has sustained him.
It's the ground beneath his feet, he would say. I envy people that have strong faith in many ways. I envy the idea of really believing that there's a bedrock of not just morality, but of a spiritual truth, you know. And I was like, I want to write from inside that guy. Not that I'm ever going to be that guy. I mean, I'll play him if we do the TV show, but
I was wondering about that, actually.
Oh, no, that's what I plan to do.
You heard that right. David Duchovny is developing a TV series based on Truly Like Lightning, and he'd play Bronson Powers. Think sort of a Big Love meets Saved by the Bell with a Duchovny spin.
You know, the first year of this show will be basically the book. After that, our hopes are that people fall in love with the milieu and the characters, and they'll be invested, and then we get to go a couple, three, four more years and tell new stories about these characters.
But for those who still want to believe, David Duchovny will return as Fox Mulder, enthusiast of aliens and the supernatural. Take heart. He won't completely rule out a return to the X-Files.
I love that show. I think that show is such a chameleon. It can exist, I think, in any time and can tell almost any story. The X-Files of the future, I don't really know what those stories are. I don't know what it looks like. So I wouldn't say no, because it might be fabulous. I don't know.
Meanwhile, for David Duchovny, there's Truly Like Lightning, the novel. And the TV show? Stay tuned. For Here and Now, I'm Emiko Tamagawa.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.